This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this is a remarkable moment, a moment that seems custom-made for this nation's curious combination of values, values of citizen justice, citizen policing. Think of it, the right to bear arms, the right of outraged citizens to overrule misguided institutions in a democracy, our expectations of security in America, the right to a trial, the judgment of a jury. All these collided when we learned the jury's verdict over the weekend, not guilty for the accused murderer of Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman. A unique collision of values and rights and laws all set amidst the equally unique tension and unresolved conflicts of race in America.
We were going to try this case in the courtroom, not in the media. And we appreciate you respecting our privacy in doing that.
Obviously, we are ecstatic with the results. George Zimmerman was never guilty of anything except protecting himself in self-defense.
Voice there of Zimmerman's defense attorney Mark O'Mara, also Florida State Attorney Angela Corey speaking on Saturday night after the verdict, and the sound of largely peaceful protests there from Los Angeles, as this case will not be tried in the courtroom, just in the courtroom. No, in the larger jury of public debate over gun laws, privacy laws, and the issue of racial profiling, and that debate has begun. Twitter verdicts came immediately in as the jury's decision was announced. Pieces of conversation as the nation weighed in. We'll be presenting that to you all hour long. Some were very emotional and bitter or even gloating. But this stood out from music producer Russell Simmons, echoing the calls from President Obama to resist violent reactions. Quote, "I know many people are very upset about the verdict, but we must remain peaceful no matter what. Remain peaceful." This was actually typical from NBA star Dwayne Wade of the Miami Heat. Wow, stunned, saddened as a father. Someone make sense of this verdict for me right now, please. Don't worry, I'll wait. Dwayne Wade is probably still waiting, as you can hear there. The nation respecting the jury verdict, also trying to glean some meaning. That's our mission this hour. What is the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman story really about? Is it about the strength of our justice system, a belief in our institutions, or is it just about race? We turn to Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whitetopia. Welcome.
Hi, John.
He's a senior fellow at DeMoss. Avis Jones-DeWeaver is host of the nationally syndicated radio show Focus Point with Avis Jones-DeWeaver. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Republican strategist Ron Christie, friend of The Takeaway here in the studio. Ron, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, John.
So, Rich, why don't you begin? What is this about? Is this an extension of the race discussion in America, a reiteration of a lot of old themes? Does this open new wounds? What do you think?
It's very much, in my opinion, an extension of the racial discussion in this country and the way that many of we black men feel that the laws are in a disservice to us, and the implicit belief that the law condoned George Zimmerman to racially profile Trayvon Martin.
The jury wasn't really permitted to consider racial profiling in its verdict. What do you think, Ron, about the question of whether blacks on a legal basis are more in harm's way as a result of this verdict?
Well, as a result of this verdict, I think people should not be in a position to try to jump to conclusions. In other words, we should not try to relitigate the 1960s based on the Trayvon Martin case. I think it's a tragedy. I think it's awful what happened to that young man. But to somehow suggest that America is at a racial tipping point or that somehow racial tensions are inflamed, I think it's a rush call to judgment.
Avis, do you think that the relative peace in response to this verdict is an acceptance of racism or a sign of the strength of our faith in institutions like the jury?
You know, ultimately, I believe that we have to accept it, right? I mean, we have no choice. But the reality is that we don't have to go back to the 1960s to find instances of racial injustice, racial profiling that leads to dangerous and potentially deadly situations. Clearly, I'm not a male of any color, but I am the mother of two black males, and one who was 17, just like Trayvon was, 6 foot tall, just like Trayvon was, skinny, just like Trayvon was, and just a week ago was stopped in his father's neighborhood, this time by a policeman, under the assumption that, quote unquote, he looked suspicious. So these are not isolated incidents. The reality is that fortunately, my son lived. Unfortunately, Trayvon died.
Rich, let me pose this to you. It's kind of an ugly question. The jury system is supposed to represent community standards. Have we reached a point in America where if you're black, wandering around with a hoodie in a gated community like Sanford, Florida, that it is a part of the community standards that you're a threat?
Yes, in very many ways. And when I said that the law condones this behavior, we don't have to go back to the 60s, as was suggested. We have stop and frisk laws here in New York City. We have local statutes that is really open season against racial profiling of immigrants. On and on and on, I could go into many examples where the law condones a certain type of racial paranoia that allows your other guest's son to be stopped without being suspicious other than his skin color or his appearance.
All right, there's a due process issue here, Ron, and there's a question of community standards. Do you believe that it's a rational response to consider someone like Trayvon Martin a threat in the community of Sanford, Florida? Is that where we're at in America right now?
Gosh, I hope not. I mean, I hope not. The fact that the young man was out at night, the fact that the young man was walking back from the store should not make him automatically a threat because of the clothes he's wearing or
the
color of
his skin. But that's what the jury seems to have said here.
No, what the jury said was, very frankly, John, I'm a lawyer. I looked at what he was charged with, what Zimmerman was charged with. He was charged with murder in the second degree in Florida, which said that he either had to have an evil mindset or a willful disregard for this person's life. The prosecution did not prove their case. Alan Dershowitz, of all people from Harvard Law School, said that the prosecutor should be disbarred for her prosecutorial misconduct. So many folks are trying to put this in racial terms when the fact of the matter is the prosecution did not live up to their burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the guilt or the innocence of the defendant.
Avis, do you think the issues of race and profiling would have been more appropriately handled if the charge had been manslaughter, essentially focusing very explicitly on what you did, George Zimmerman, took a life. We don't care about your intent, but you did something wrong here and you're going to pay.
Well, let's remember that though, there was a charge of second degree murder, the jury could also consider manslaughter. So, you know, it's a misnomer to assume that they only had to consider second degree murder. So, yes, the fact of the matter is that this young man was portrayed by the defense attorneys as a menacing threat. They put a picture in front of the jury with him without a shirt on, looking very stern, as if he's some evildoer that is about to pounce out and attack someone. And they never had to explain, for example, what would exactly be the motivation of someone who is trying to get back home, talking to a friend on the phone, wanting to catch a basketball game, to all of a sudden lurch out and attack a complete stranger with the very convenient words of, you're going to die tonight. There was no sort of attempt to even explain what is the motivation behind that. The only one in that encounter who had a motivation to attack was the person who told the dispatcher, these blanks always get away. You know, that to me describes intent in a very, very specific term. That to me was the person who had a motivation to go after and confront someone, not someone who's trying to go home with Skittles and iced tea.
Avis Jones DeWeaver is the host of the nationally syndicated radio show Focus Point with Avis Jones DeWeaver. Rich Benjamin, does popular culture create an opportunity for defense lawyers to paint every black man as a thug in a way that juries are going to have a whole repertoire of images to draw on and that defense attorneys have got kind of an open season here?
Absolutely. But popular culture also presents white men as a threat. My concern is with the law and that a legal system that condones the racial profiling. And so in his head, George Zimmerman had it that with all these laws that it's almost all right. But anyway, moving forward, the question is, who is going to write our laws? Who is going to enforce our laws? The kids in Newton didn't feel safe. The kids, the Aurora shooting didn't feel safe. So this makes me wonder, what is it going to require to have our kids safe in America? The idea that whether you're mentally ill, whether you're paranoid, whether you're a racist, you have open season on kids, and it's stand-your-ground laws, and it's a gun lobby that allows this to happen. And so that's my focus, is that it's not simply a racial issue. It's keeping kids safe from menacing and very violent people.
So what do we do today? Let's put that to all three of you here. What do we do today? And the thing that Americans should do today is different from the people in communities like Sanford, Florida should do today, because they've got the stand your ground laws. We don't have that necessarily all over the United States. And the gun laws and the approach to the right to bear arms in Florida is very different from the prevailing sense nationally. Give me a sense of what you would do as a Floridian today, Ron Christie, and what you would do as an American today to try to actually make meaningful change.
Well, I think one thing that we have to do, John, is that we have to recognize that we're all Americans. we shouldn't profile, we shouldn't discriminate, we shouldn't look at people and think that they're suspicious or somehow prone to violent behavior because of their outward appearance. Obviously, you have to take common sense, but the notion that a young black man walking home at night is somehow a threat, I think, is something that we as Americans need to recognize. That's wrong. It's profiling, and we deserve, and frankly, we need to do better by this country because we're not standing up to our ideals.
What's the do here? That's a can't we all get along kind of speech.
Yeah, well, that is the do. The do is that you actually have to reflect and contemplate on that and recognize that there are biases that people bring to the table and people still do discriminate.
Rich?
The do is to monitoring law enforcement, their horrific missteps immediately after the crime scene. The do is to stand up to NRA. The do is to stand up to ALEC. Because even with
ALEC
the racism—
ALEC is the conservative writer of laws like some of the gun laws that are in place in Florida.
And the anti-immigration laws and et cetera, et cetera. So the do is to stand up to all these forces. Because we do have the racism, often we can't change people's hearts. But we can change the law that does them a disservice once that racism is exposed.
All right, Avis, what's your do as a Floridian and as a member of this country? Your thoughts?
The do is to register to vote. Because you cannot be on a jury pool unless you are registered to vote. So if you know someone who isn't, particularly if you are African-American, because I do think that that is a factor in this trial as well, that there were no African-Americans on the jury, that it makes sense to maximize the jury pool representation of African-Americans. I also think, frankly, as a mother of black sons, the to-dos for my son, and I'm going to be very specific, is to make sure that my children have self-defense training. I am very, very serious about that. A verdict like this, in my mind, puts crosshairs on the backs of young men who look like my 17-year-old kid, and I want to make sure that he lives.
Rich Benjamin, do all juries now consider the Zimmerman circumstances in a self-defense case in a criminal court in the United States?
I believe so. And I want to reiterate what Avis is saying, is that it puts the crosshairs on the backs of young black men, even if the outcome won't be as dramatic as a killing, because people will do a calculus that says the law, the full weight of American law, stood behind George Zimmerman. And even if I don't shoot a black person, I can racially profile them, I can harass them because George Zimmerman got away with it. And as for Avis's recommendation that she is going to get her kids self-training, I think that makes total sense to me, but it's just devastating. As a black male who is in tip-top shape, the idea that I have to learn self-defense in order to disarm a potential assailant. My white and Asian friends don't have that consideration. So on the one hand, I don't at all disagree with her, but the implications of what she's just recommended are horrifying.
Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whitetopia, senior fellow at Demos. Avis Jones-DeWeaver, host of the nationally syndicated radio show Focus Point with Avis Jones-DeWeaver, and Ron Christie, Republican strategist. Thanks to all three of you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Hi, this is William Szilagyi from Prince Amboy, New Jersey, and personally, as a white guy who's okay with the not guilty verdict, can't have a conversation with anyone who thinks that George Zimmerman is guilty without being called a racist.
What do you think about the George Zimmerman verdict? We always want to hear from you. You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. You're part of this national conversation. So what are the implications for juries going forward on the issue of self-defense? Will all juries consider the George Zimmerman case and the George Zimmerman circumstances in deciding their verdicts? Cheryl Eiffel from the University of Maryland, she's a law professor there. She's also president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. She joins us on the line with us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to ask you a series of blunt questions because I think there's a lot of really big issues in play here. First of all, do you think this verdict, regardless of the finding of fact here, enlarges the circumstances where self-defense is an acceptable rationale for the killing of someone?
I think that's the fear. You know, obviously we care about what happened in this case and we care about Trayvon Martin, but we also care about the message that it sends to people all over this country about what they are able to do with their gun when they have been the pursuer, when they were the aggressor of an engagement with another individual. It's a very frightening potential outcome, and I've heard from so many parents who just talked about the fear they have for their children.
How does this bear most directly on the African-American community, in your view?
If we're honest with ourselves, we realize that there are many stereotypes and biases associated with African-Americans and criminality, particularly African-American men. That's why Trayvon Martin, walking through his own father's neighborhood wearing a hoodie, could look intimidating, but perhaps Mark Zuckerberg wearing a hoodie and walking through the same neighborhood would not. And so we recognize that there is such a thing as racial profiling. It is not something in the created in the imagination of African Americans. It is real, and it's a reality that comes out of our history. We have embedded ideas about race, and so because of that, you know, it's something that we all have to struggle against. And verdicts like this, you know, make us fear because we recognize that people like George Zimmerman make assumptions about who African Americans are, particularly young African American men. And that can then lead to an altercation and a set of circumstances like we saw in this case.
Do you believe, thinking about the president's statement over the weekend, that an acceptance and a respect for the jury's verdict here by the broad population of Americans is a strength of the criminal justice system in our country or an acceptance of racism?
Well, I'm not sure those two are in contrast, but we're a nation of laws and not of men. We believe in the rule of law, and so we accept the jury's verdict. We may disagree with the jury's verdict, but we have to accept it. We should also remember that those of us not on the jury, not on the sequestered jury, are at home watching television each day. We're seeing all kinds of information and evidence that they never saw and that they never heard and that they were not allowed to consider, frankly, in reaching their verdict. And so, you know, we have to respect the jury's verdict. This is the nation that we live in. They heard a prescribed set of evidence. There were many pieces of evidence that the prosecution wanted to bring into the case that they did not bring into the case. You'll recall that the judge would not even allow the prosecution to use the words racial profiling. They were only allowed to say profiling. So we have action about the jury's verdict based on all of the things that we know and think we know. But the jury heard a circumscribed set of evidence. That's how our legal system works.
Do you believe that it is lawyering that makes it harder for juries to consider the broadest set of facts here, or is it the laws themselves that make it difficult for juries to reconcile self-defense, a right to bear arms, a right to privacy, and the question of intent to commit bodily harm?
Well, in this particular case, I think that our failure to fully understand that we have to deal honestly with race, not excluding it from the presentation of facts in a case when it is clearly relevant to the case, is deeply problematic. I don't want to second-guess Judge Nelson, but the reality is, you know, you hear people today saying, did this case have anything to do with race? You hear Mark O'Mara, the defense attorney, saying this case had nothing to do with civil rights. This case would never have been brought had it not been for civil rights protests all over the country. George Zimmerman would never have been arrested. He would never have been brought to trial. This would have been a young black man who was killed by another man who was allowed to go to his home and stay there. So I don't think it's the, you know, our legal system that interferes with the ability of juries to hear the facts. I think it is the pervasive view among too many in this country, including those who operate in the legal system, judges and lawyers alike, that if we simply ignore race, we will believe that we have overcome race. And we have to become more mature. We have to be willing to engage honestly with race in this country. It's part of our DNA. It's part of who we are. We actually can grapple with it. And when we run away from it, we produce a result that really is at odds with the reality of what happened.
Sherrilyn Ifill, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Sherrilyn Ifill is University of Maryland law professor and president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. So bearing on that conversation, we want to give you a sense of the national conversation as it sort of came down on Twitter once the verdict was announced. Here's an interesting comment from Dave Weigel of Slate Magazine. The outrage in 2012 about Trayvon Martin's death was that Zimmerman wasn't being tried at all. He was tried. This is how the system works. Here's an interesting celebrity comment or set of celebrity comments. Donald Trump: Zimmerman is no angel. But the lack of evidence and the concept of self-defense, especially in Florida law, gave the jury little other choice. Ann Coulter tweeted hallelujah right after the verdict in support of Zimmerman and then received an angry answer from actress Olivia Wilde, who said to Coulter, "You are a hateful wench." That's a quote. Steve Harvey, "A child is dead and the man that killed him is free. And again, the child is black. My country, tis of thee." Mia Farrow said, "I don't understand this at all." Actor Richard Dreyfuss said, "It's 2013. An American jury just acquitted a man who admitted to stalking and killing an unarmed child." Actress Ellen Page, "If you really believe racism isn't a massive problem, that the oppression of minorities is not a horrific and systemic issue, you are in denial." And actress Jennifer Hudson, "I can't help but think of what my mama used to say, if you think you've seen it all, just keep on living." Two tweets, one from Trayvon Martin's dad, "Thanks to everyone who's with us and who will be with us so we together can make sure this doesn't happen again." And George Zimmerman's father, "Our whole family's relieved. Today, I'm proud to be an American. God bless America. Thank you for your prayers." You can weigh in. You don't have to use Twitter, but you can. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. So we started this hour with a panel of African-American columnists and media types about the implications of the George Zimmerman not guilty verdict. We've been also giving you a sample of passions and comments flaring on Twitter from politicians and celebrities. The pundit Planet, just turn on the television, is fully engaged here. But the most important conversations may be the ones families are having around their own dinner tables.
This is Denise in Charlotte, North Carolina. I have nephews around the same age as Trayvon Martin. And my sisters and I are telling them that they are never to engage with strangers. And as a black male, they are inherently feared. They are presumed dangerous. And it's not fair. It's not right. But it's a reality that they live in.
That's right. Perhaps the most meaningful African-American commentators in the wake of this verdict are parents, not pundits. Joining us now, Lamar Tyler, founder of Black and MarriedWithKids.com. He's also the father of a 19-year-old son and young daughters. Lamar, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Christy Oglesby is with us, mother of a 12-year-old son. She lives in Atlanta, recently wrote a piece for CNN.com entitled "My 12-Year-Old Son Knows He Could Be Trayvon." Her son is now 13 years old. Christy, welcome.
Good morning, John.
I'm the white guy in this conversation. Let me just say, how is what you're telling your kids different from what I heard as a youngster? Obviously, in a very different context, you know, stay away from strangers, leave strangers alone. They'll grab you and put you in their car. Christy?
I think the difference primarily would be is that I'm telling my son more information about how some people might view him. I doubt that your parents were telling you that someone might see you as a suspect or someone might view you as dangerous. So I'm giving my son a little bit more context. I'm not talking about abduction necessarily with him. That's a different conversation. I'm talking to him more about his deportment and how to try to offset what some people might assume about him, that he has to have a certain demeanor and a certain way of carrying himself that will try to mitigate some of the prejudices that some people might come to the table about him. He's a very large child, and I know that.
Lamar, what have you said, and how would you sort of contextualize the fear of strangers conversation that all parents have with this particular incident?
Just kind of going right along with what Chrissy was saying, this is conversation we didn't just start with having in the last year with what happened with Trayvon Martin with our son. It was a conversation we had during his entire upbringing. And even with my young daughter now, when we sat and talked about the verdict and what happened there. She has a diverse group of friends. So a conversation we have with her is not just about, people approaching you, but it's about how people view you. And even though you may be with your friends, you may not be able to act the same way they act, because if something goes wrong, you'll most likely be the one that gets blamed, because people may have a specific outlook and prejudice against you that they may not have against your diverse group of friends.
Now, kids aren't known for necessarily taking parental advice and writing it down as their own personal, rules to go by. How has that changed in the wake of this very high-profile news story, Lamar?
Well, I think this is a very teachable moment, and exactly for that point. So this is a conversation, like I said, we've been having with our son for years, and we tell him You know, watch what you put on social media, watch the way you dress, because people, when they see you as an African-American male, it's these preconceived notions that they already have about you.
And he's been going, yeah.
Exactly. Right. You know, that's just like any kid would, right? But I think this is a very teachable moment. And we saw how after what happened to Trayvon Martin, you know, they pulled up his social media pages. They pulled up, you know, all these different things in his past that a lot of teenagers have done and are doing currently across this country. But they reflected it and tried to turn him into a thug and a bad guy because of it. So, like I said, more than anything, we're just able to use this as a teachable moment to kind of tie into some of the things we've already been saying.
Assess how this moment changes your relationship with your own son, Christy.
I would tell you, similar to what Lamar has said, it's always been a part of his upbringing, but I'll share this anecdote with you. Last week, Drew took a dog sitting job, and it's only two doors down. And the last time he lets the dogs out, it's between 9 and 9:30. And so I told him that I would go to our neighbor's house and walk home with him each night. And he felt annoyed. He felt as if I was infringing on his job, and he's a young adult, and he can walk two or three doors down without a problem. So for the past 4 days, I had shown up between 9 and 9:30 to walk home with him. And he absolutely seems annoyed by my presence. Yesterday, however, he called me just before 9 o'clock, and he asked, and he said, "Mom, are you coming to walk me home?" And I said, "Yes, I'll be there about 9:15. And I knew based on the conversations we had Saturday night why he asked me. So when we got there and we locked up the house and we started to walk home, and I said, "So you don't mind me being here now?" And he said, "No, I feel safer. I feel safer."
So
it broke my heart a little, but there was no pushback. He didn't feel put upon about his mom infringing on his job anymore.
So this news story gets rid of the mom's walking with me in the neighborhood. I mean, that's powerful. It sounds silly, but that's powerful social change.
It is. And it's, you know, he's also on the track team, and he's always had rules. I don't allow him to run in the neighborhood. We live in a large subdivision, and the people who live in our cul-de-sac might know him. But if he's practicing for cross country, I just can't let him run a mile away from home. And so he's always known, as Lamar said, this is a conversation we had. And again, he feels annoyed practicing for cross country on a flat track instead of in our hilly neighborhood. But there is a change. He does want additional protection. Even though he's 5'10", which makes him 6 inches taller than I am, he wanted his mother with him.
All right, let's focus on something that may be a little more provocative here. Are you looking at people in your neighborhood now, Christy, and going, "That's a George Zimmerman over there, that guy? I don't like him. He's walking around. He looks a little
maybe he's going after my son. I'm not. We've lived there 16 years. As I said, it's a large subdivision. I don't know every new family that comes in. And unfortunately, we're sort of a garage community. Everybody presses the garage door opener and we drive in and we rarely see each other. There's normally someone else who takes care of our lawns. We might see each other at the pool, but we don't all know one another. It's a tough line to walk between not being cynical and bitter and afraid and trying to imbue in this young black male that you take the world with confidence and be proud in who you are. I'm not looking at everyone in my neighborhood that way. And it's hard to tell my son not to look at everyone that way. But I need him to understand that some people will look at him as a threat, and he needs to try to mitigate that opinion of himself.
Got to ask you, Lamar, are you looking for George Zimmerman's in your neighborhood all of a sudden?
I'm not. And I think most African-American parents aren't really changing the way that they've been doing the business of parenting. I think the biggest change in this is what the kids see, because I think they had pretty much, regardless of what we said, bought into this idea of the post-racial America and the idea that we had a black president and they have white friends and Indian friends and Asian friends, so everything is okay. But like I said, more than anything, I think this just was a wake-up call and a teachable moment for them, that there really are some issues that we've been telling them about for years that have come to the surface.
Well, Lamar and Christy, thanks for letting us sit at your dinner table.
Thank you so much.
Nasty bit of business now in what some have called the annals of dysfunctional democracy. It's all happening in the U.S. Senate. The decorum and sense of collegiality between the majority leader in the Senate, Harry Reid, and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has reached a point that the Senate may be showing signs of shutdown, paralysis, and even worse, electoral showdown. Our good friend Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, has a name for this electoral showdown. What do you call it, Todd?
I call it filibuster failure, pretty much, John, which
you
is what we might be headed for.
You call it the nuclear option.
Oh, well, that's what everybody else calls it. You're right. It is the nuclear option, and you've heard this term before. I don't want to reprise an old movie, but if they were going to make the sci-fi movie Nuclear Option, it would be this time it's real, because it is. John, both Harry Reid, Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, Minority Leader, appearing on Meet the Press on NBC yesterday, getting ready for a showdown. Listen to Harry Reid.
Well, listen, I want everyone to hear this. The changes we're making are very, very minimal. What we're doing is saying, look, American people, shouldn't President Obama have somebody working for him that he wants?
And here's Mitch McConnell.
I hope we'll come to our senses and not change the core of the Senate. We have never changed the rules of the Senate by breaking the rules of the Senate in order to diminish the voices of individual senators. We've never done that, and we sure shouldn't start it now.
This is all about the 60-vote rule and the presidential appointments gridlock that's really been exacerbated in this term of Congress, even though it's well known.
Back in 2005, when Republicans were in control, they threatened to do this nuclear option, which is basically using lots of quirks in the Senate rules to say filibuster on judges, gone. We're going to take away the minority's right to filibuster them and pass them all with 51 votes, just like the House would with majority rule. This isn't about judges. Flash forward to 2013. President Obama, Democrats highly frustrated over President Obama's appointments, his executive appointments. There are 16 appointments that are sitting waiting in the wings for 8 or 9 months. But, John, this is really, really not about the EPA or the Department of Labor.
No.
This is really about two agencies that kind of fly under the radar that are incredibly important to Washington and even more important to Wall Street. They are the National Labor Relations Board and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, both with major implications for business and industry in Wall Street. Republicans don't like either of these agencies. They're holding up nominees. If President Obama doesn't get a nominee on the Labor Relations Board, it can't function legally because it has to be bipartisan. There won't be a quorum. His appointee, Richard Cordray, for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, was recess appointed. There's a Supreme Court case about it. Republicans have no problem with him, but they don't like that agency. They want to change the rules that governs it, and they won't approve this guy until they get their changes. Harry Reid is saying, no. You guys can't hold up these nominees for that purpose, and I'm going to use these quirks in the rules to say no more filibusters on presidential nominees. And there's every indication from senators, John, even though Harry Reid is well known around Washington for bluffing, this time he might not be.
And there are recess appointment issues going to the Supreme Court in both the NLRB and this Consumer Protection Agency, as you've alluded to there. But a lot of this is all about Reid and McConnell themselves. I mean, I'm looking at the Twitter responses to some of the rhetoric that came down last week and just assessments of these guys' relationship. I mean, they sound civil on Meet the Press, but that's not what's going on here.
And it's really hard to tell how much of this is about them and how much of it is about broader issues. Don't forget, they're both under major pressure from their parties to look tough, more importantly, to be tough. If it is about a tiff between Reid and McConnell, the odd couple of Washington politics, John, a rare meeting this evening in the old Senate chamber just down the hall from Mitch McConnell's office. 100 senators lock the doors, 100 people in the room, no press, no aides, to talk it out and see if there's an exit ramp. I call it the ultimate wish you were the fly in the wall conversation. That's this evening.
Hey, Todd, why don't you try to crash that meeting? Will you do that for us?
I will be outside the door, John. If I can get in, you'll be the first to know about it.
Talk to you tomorrow. Other Washington news here. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano announced last week that she will be resigning from her post to become the president of the University of California system, often called an ungovernable collection of institutions with totally different styles and agendas. The University of California system may be the perfect place to land after the Department of Homeland Security, which includes the U.S. Immigration and Customs Agency, the TSA, those folks at the airport that screen your baggage, FEMA, the Coast Guard, the Secret Service, a domestic nuclear detection office and training operation for federal officers. Michael Chertoff is a former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. He's currently chairman of the Chertoff Group. Michael Chertoff, thanks for joining us.
Hello, John.
Let's talk about the ungovernability of this agency. Tom Ridge had difficulty, you much less so, but what would you say the status of the governability of the Department of Homeland Security is, and assess Napolitano's leadership?
Well, I think that after 10 years, the department has actually matured quite a bit. And I would think that the myth of ungovernability really is no longer accurate. There's a pretty good system now of organizing across the various lines of functional behavior. They've got a well-integrated planning system. I think that Secretary Napolitano continued that process of building and integrating, which I think was part of the original vision. So the department is in a much better place now. There's one thing that still needs to be corrected, though, and that is the unwieldy congressional reporting system, which requires literally dozens of committees to be reported to by the department. And that's the one piece of unfinished business that was recommended by the 9/11 Commission that the next secretary ought to tackle.
And it's a big issue because the original vision of the Department of Homeland Security under George W. Bush was that it would be apolitical, that it would be insulated from Congress, and in a sense, both the political appointees that run the agency and these reporting requirements mean that the Department of Homeland Security is dialed into Congress more than ever, and we see that with the immigration bill right now.
Well, I think that's right. It's not so much that the congressional oversight mess creates more politics. It's that it creates conflicting directions. Most departments, like the Department of Defense, you know, principally deal with one oversight committee in the House and one in the Senate. And that creates a relationship in which Congress takes responsibility for its part of the oversight process and gives clear direction. What you still have with DHS now is a number of committees who claim that oversight. They often have very different views of what the department ought to do. That winds up actually hurting the department, but it also handicaps Congress because if everybody speaks, then in a way nobody is listened to.
As a longtime observer of Washington, a final question. Given the domestic surveillance controversy that the Obama administration is currently under, obviously Homeland Security is something every government has to deal with, but we also have a Department of Defense. It seems like there is so much overwhelming investment in searching out enemies across the world and even inside our own borders that maybe the U.S. needs to relax a little bit. We invest way too much in our Homeland Security.
Well, you know, that's an argument you did not hear after the Boston Marathon bombing. And I don't think you'd hear that argument if we relaxed and we had more bombings, or if we had something even worse than a bombing, like a biological attack or a cyber attack. And by the way, we are under attack in cyberspace all the time now. So I think there's, at this point, maybe a little bit of an overreaction and an exaggeration of the degree to which we're investing in security. And I think in particular, a lot of the noise around this set of Snowden revelations really misunderstands what we do in surveillance, misunderstands how much legal oversight there is, and really is focusing on an issue that we debated fully back 5 or 6 years ago when the law was modified to the current regime.
He's currently chairman of the Chertoff Group. Michael Chertoff is former Department of Homeland Security Secretary. Mr. Secretary, thanks so much.
Great. Bye.
What is the future for the nation of Egypt? Particularly, what is the U.S. role in that future? Deputy Secretary of State William Burns is in Cairo today, the first U.S. official to visit Egypt since the military-backed government took over earlier this month. Over the weekend, hundreds of thousands of Egyptian Islamists took to the streets in a show of support for President Mohamed Morsi, now former president, who was removed from office by the military earlier this month. At the same time, the interim government has been cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood, arresting officials, freezing their assets. Robin Wright is a distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington. She's an author. She's most recently the editor of The Islamists Are Coming, Who They Really Are. Robin Wright, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
So let's talk about Deputy Secretary of State William Burns in Cairo. He's going to be meeting with some folks who are familiar because the U.S. has a long history with military leaders and military officials at many, many levels in the Egyptian government over the years.
Well, the challenge for the Obama administration right now is navigating a very delicate course between the military that has claimed power since a coup and the people who were democratically elected for the first time in Egypt's 5,000-year history, and some of whose leadership are now under basically house arrest. And it's trying to get Egypt to move faster on this transition, this second transition to democracy, and to justify continued U.S. support. This is a very contentious issue in Washington now, and there are people on the Hill who have already called for the suspension of U.S. aid. And so I think the administration is trying to see if it can navigate a course that will lead to the Muslim Brotherhood leaders being freed, sense that they Muslim Brotherhood members who were democratically elected do continue to participate in a political process, and that the military sticks to a timetable that will get them through a transition very quickly.
Isn't it more likely, though, Robin Wright, right now, that the U.S. is caught in a very different kind of process, a sort of tit-for-tat process, where the military is now doing to the Morsi government what the protesters did to Mubarak, and they're perceived as sort of doing turnabout fair play here, and the U.S. basically can find no middle ground?
It's going to be very hard to find middle ground. And frankly, the passions, political passions, are inflamed right now in Egypt. These rival protests every day with no sense that there's going to be a cessation. There was a hope that during the month of Ramadan, which began last week, and when Muslims fast from dawn to dusk, that there might be a lessening of tensions and visibility on the streets, but that's only increased. The big challenge is, does Egypt turn to the model of Turkey in 1997 when a military pushed aside a government and the Islamist party regrouped and ran again and came out even stronger? Or does it follow the model of Algeria in 1992 when the military pushed aside again a democratically elected government in transition and it led to a civil war where for a decade that produced over 200,000 dead? So this is what the U.S. is trying to do right now in making sure that the tensions don't flare up into an outright conflict.
Among policymakers in the United States, is this a situation of, aha, we told you so on the Islamists regarding Mohamed Morsi, or is it more a question of they're not ready to govern, there needs to be a different kind of transition for the Muslim Brothers to become a governing force as opposed to simply an insurgency?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood made some very serious mistakes. President Morsi last November on Thanksgiving, in fact, assumed power over the judiciary. And he did that in part because the judiciary, many of whose leaders had been appointed by President Mubarak, had suspended a democratically elected parliament. He was afraid that what they call the deep state, the old regime of Hosni Mubarak that dominated the military and the judiciary, was trying to undo the democratic process. And so what's really played out since then are the politics of fear, both sides fearing that the other was trying to undo it. And Egypt's democratic culture is very fragile, you know, at this moment that the secular opposition has not been very good about providing an alternative. And that's one of the reasons I think the military stepped in, that the protesters knew what they were against, but they didn't provide a Nelson Mandela. They didn't provide a platform of ideas. The opposition was very, very divided, dominated in many ways by ego rather than political vision.
Is there a sense in which the U.S. should feel good about Egypt finally having a very deep secular versus Islamist discussion of how it's going to rule? Or you seem to believe it's going to get worse before it gets better in Egypt. Why?
Well, I think the United States would love to see some kind of discussion or debate between among the very many political factions in Egypt. The problem is that hasn't happened. And the danger is that the action taken by the military will only deepen suspicions. I think political tensions are going to get worse. I'm not sure that we're going to see the Algeria model. I think even the Turkish leadership is trying to urge the Muslim Brotherhood to regroup and run. But, of course, it doesn't recognize the new government. It doesn't recognize President Mansour, who was appointed by the military. And so we're at this stalemate that could get very ugly if there isn't some kind of reconciliation. And I think that's in part what the United States is trying to do. The tragedy is the United States has arguably never had less influence in Egypt because the military, which is actually supported by the United States, and the secular opposition feel that the U.S. was very supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood while it was in power. And the Muslim Brotherhood feels that it has been betrayed because the United States has accepted what was a military coup against a democratic government. So current ambassador in Egypt, Ann Patterson, who's a very capable diplomat, has been blamed for a lot of the tensions.
Well, it certainly feels as though some of the suspicion left over from many years of believing in CIA coups, you know, engineered by the United States, is partly at work here, although the Egyptians will certainly have to resolve this for themselves. Robin Wright, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.